I got a few short questions. Then what we'll do is we'll throw it out to everybody so you guys can ask questions.
Short questions, long answers.
Short questions, long answers. Sounds very good. Now, you were you studied at Vassar and the University of Southern California. Mm-hmm. Now, did you originally plan to do comics, or were you headed in to become sort of a literary
novelist? Well, I think there are maybe three people in the industry who planned to do comics. I think it's Mark Waid, Scott McCloud, and Kurt Busiek. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it. I think everybody else loves comics and then ends up getting a chance. So I found comics early. I remember being, 6, 7, standing in the checkout line at supermarket in Salinas, California, behind my mom, and there being the little digest-sized Archie comics and little digest black and white reprints of like the first 5 issues of, Lee and Kirby on The Incredible Hulk. And those were the first comics I can actually remember owning. Comics are their own language, and they are a very direct feed form of storytelling. I think if you get them into the hands of young kids, you're going to hook them, because I think the visual to text translation that is happening in their heads is mirrored on the page. I didn't get serious about collecting comics until I was 12 or 13, and I changed schools and I fell in with a group of Marvel zombies. And they were Marvel zombies. And, it was X-Men all the time. And then that led to, going to comic book stores and finding stuff on my own. So I went to college and at that point had decided I wanted to try to write one. So I had a friend who was at a different college who decided he wanted to draw one. So I wrote it, and he drew it, and I wrote the second issue, and he turned to me and said, "This is too much work, I don't want to do it anymore." So I finished writing it, just because I think at that point I was young and full of energy, and it mattered to me to finish it. So, but, it was not, there was not a direct point where I said, this is the career trajectory. The career trajectory was all over the place, as it is for most people. There were things I wanted to do. And then I eventually realized, whatever I was doing, I was writing. And I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to tell stories. Comics is just another writing medium. So, there's not a direct focus line, but it all sort of aggregates to it.
Now your first Kodiak novel was in 1996. and then Whiteout came a couple years later.
Yeah, Whiteout was 98, 99.
And I'm just wondering, now you said you had done a couple issues of a comic that remains unpublished.
Yeah, I mean, it was done with a friend of mine. What would happen is my wife and I would, we were very young and poor, and I'd gotten out of graduate school, and she had started graduate school, and we would go to the San Diego Comic-Con back when it was a Comic-Con, as opposed to what it is now, which is not a Comic-Con. And I had sold, Keeper came out in 96. I sold it in, I think, 95, 94. So there was a period where the book existed, and I was working on it, and I was getting ready to come out, and we had gone from being so poor we were gaining weight, if this makes sense. We couldn't eat well. So all you ate were carbs, to finding, our first tentative security. And I would go to San Diego, and I would try to get publishers, I want to write comics. Look, I have a novel. And they would be like, go away. And what happened was Keeper came out, and the friend who drew the comic that was eventually aborted was working at DC in marketing and gave Keeper to his boss, and she started trying to help me out and get me work in the industry. It's a woman named Patty Jarris, and Oni Press was starting up, and she introduced me to Bob Schreck and Joe Nuzman.
Oh, okay.
And that was how Whiteout came about. I went to them with the books. And we met at San Diego. We met out, if you've ever been to the San Diego Comic Con, big convention hall, one side faces San Diego, other side faces Marina. There's a mezzanine level. We went out on the mezzanine, and Shrek, I remember, looked at me and he said, with the book in his hand, he said, "You don't want to make a comic out of this." For those of you who are novelists and want to become comics writers, that is a trick question. The answer is no. And that's why I said, no, it's a novel. I have an idea for a comic. The idea is a murder mystery set in Antarctica. It's a very visual story. It would work better as a comic. And we sort of went from there. And they were nervous. You know, they were starting out. They didn't, you know, they knew they were going to republish Frank Miller's Bad Boy. Mm-hmm. And I think they were kind of sidling up to Kevin Smith at that point, going, then they didn't know me from Adam. All they knew was there's this guy who wrote these novels. So they read, at that point, when the meeting happened, I think I had two out, and the third was coming. And so they went off, and Bob and Joe read them separately, and both came back and said, "Okay, yes, we would like to work with you." And I wrote, I think, the first issue of Whiteout I had written and given to them before we started hunting around for artists, and that's eventually how we found Steve Lieber. Yeah.
Okay. So you didn't know Steve prior to that?
No. No, I met Steve at... I met him twice. The first time I met him was at a comic show in Portland, Oregon. And a comic show in Portland, Oregon makes this show look like E3. I mean, they're like eight people. And Oni, I don't think they'd actually started publishing anything yet. Or they might have just started, but they had a table, and I went, and Bob said, "Go take a look down there and see what you think." And there were, you know, Artist Alley, and I went and I looked at Steve's stuff. You know, he didn't know me. He was like, "Oh, take a look." And I was like, "Ooh." Came back to Bob. I was like, "Yeah, you can do it. It'd be good." So we gave him the script and a couple of the novels. And I think as Steve tells it, he was like, "Hey, I want to draw this." So I think also because he'd been drawing Hawkman at that point, and here I was going, "No, draw Antarctica and people without wings and things like that, and blood. Draw blood."
So lots of snow.
Yeah.
No background.
Yeah, see, you know what? Just speaking from the artist's point of view, it sounds deceptively easy. I know what Steve did to get the results, in particular on the first book. You know, there are literally pages, if you open up Whiteout, you can see his fingerprints. There are blood smears. I mean, he was cutting himself. He was razor blading papers. This is back before he could computer generate Zip-A-Tone.
Right.
So he was cutting Zip-A-Tone and laying it in. And I mean, if you ever get one of the original pages and you hold it up flat, you'll see texture levels, you know, where he's literally shaved the pages to get the results he wants. So.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really was something.
And apparently he did a lot of visual research for it.
We researched it out. This nose. I actually think, along with some of the novels, I did more research on Whiteout than on anything else. I mean, any other project I've done. And at that time, the time I was writing it, we were very close to, we lived very close to a library, and I would spend all day in the library, you know, and it was anything visual I could get, and this was before you could go to the web for all this stuff, too, you know. Yeah, we were sending each other images, and I read like six, seven different accounts of my winter of terror, you know, surviving the South Pole, and, you know, Serena Fiennes is, you know, "I crossed Antarctica on two huskies and a Triscuit," you know, and I mean, just, I read all of this stuff, and that's one of the reasons, actually, why the first Whiteout is a little heavy on research, actually. If you read it, there's sections that are almost pedantic, and, you know, "This is what Antarctica is," and it's like, yes, yes, yes. Story, please.
Which isn't so bad, because it's not something that we get a lot of information.
No, but...
But you're
never writing a polemic. You
right.
know? I mean, the goal is, I love environment as character. I always do. And one of the things that I'm told is I'm very good at evoking place. But the way you do this, and I was talking about this earlier, is, you know, your research has to be unobtrusive. The best research... How many people read Tom Clancy novels? I'm pleased to see so few. But you read stuff like that, and you'll see, like, he pulled out a Heckler & Co. G3 20-inch barrel, 9mm, and all it is a paragraph and a half of fact. And it's like, get it, I don't care. Right. Or you say a sniper rifle. Two words. If you want to get really crazy, you say a Heckler & Co. sniper rifle. And that's, how much do you need?
Right.
All right? Now, as a narrative device to say, okay, it is the highest, driest, windiest continent in the world, these facts will now become important later in the story. That's a different tool. Or to describe abstractly, to say, thinking of a book by Adam Hall called The Quiller Memorandum, that there are a couple chapters that begin with very technical descriptions of a bullet flight or the maneuver required to kill somebody in a car without dying yourself or whatnot. That is arcane knowledge that adds to character, as opposed to an info dump, which is dull. It's painfully dull, and nothing kicks, you know, literally it kicks you out of the story faster. And for me, the way research has to work is I have to get almost too much of it. And if I immerse myself in it, then what happens is that details come out organically, and you get the iceberg effect. You can see one quarter and the other three quarters are below. But if the one quarter you see, you know there's more down there. And that adds to the verisimilitude. So,
in the early days, you had spent some...
I told you the answers were long.
That's all right.
In your He's going, wow, well, I was really afraid he was going to be...
This is really good information for writers, and that's exactly what we want. That's the whole purpose of this.
We should qualify it and say, look, anything I say, even if I say it's not, is an opinion. It's what works for me.
Sure.
I had very, very early on. For those of you who are sitting there going, "How do you write?" I have an anecdote. I'll give you an anecdote. As has been explained, I went to Vassar College for my undergraduate degree, and I had been writing throughout college, but I had been unable to actually ever get any creative writing training. I could never get in any of the courses because you had to audition, and I was just passed over. For freshman, sophomore, junior year. And my senior year, I figured it was a done deal. I wasn't going to be able to do fiction. I thought that my senior thesis, I was going to be an English major. I was an English major, I should say. And in the English department at Vassar, you had to do a senior thesis. And I figured, well, there's one fiction section, and then there are a whole bunch of other. I'm not going to be in the fiction. So I'm going to write about my passion. I was going to write, my thesis was going to be on the American private investigator as a means of social commentary, : from Marlowe to Spencer. Because I think about these things. And lo and behold, I got into senior composition, which was the fiction workshop. And basically over the course of the year, instead of writing a thesis, what you did is you wrote short stories, and at the end of the year, your short story collection was your thesis. And it was taught by a wonderful writer, a guy named Frank Burgone. And Frank would have writers in to talk to us. And over the course of the year, we had like three or four different writers come in. Some wonderful writers, and everybody had a different take. And I remember there was a guy in the class the last time the last writer had come in and left. And we had a little time afterwards. And this guy, his name was Zach, turned to Burgone and he said, "I have come to a conclusion." And Burgone said, "What's that?" And he said, "They're all full of shit. None of them says the same thing. They don't. Nobody has any advice. They don't know what they're talking about." And Burgone said, "Or maybe they're all right." And that to me was revelatory, because there isn't a single path. There are certain things that I can tell you all, but people say, "How do I break into comics?" And I say, "I don't know. I wrote novels. I don't recommend that as a trajectory for entry. You know, I had to struggle to get my novels sold before I could get into comics. That's clearly not going to work for everybody." You know, how did Jeff Johns get into comics? Jeff Johns got into comics because he was Richard Donner's assistant, and they were shooting Conspiracy Theory in New York. And some of the DC people met up, and that's parlayed into Jeff getting work at DC. Right, so all of you, off the Hollywood, get jobs as director's assistants. You see what I mean? It doesn't work. It's not consistent. And the industry keeps changing. So this is just by way of saying, you know, the information may be of use, or this may simply be an enjoyable way to waste an hour. There you go.
We'll take it either way.
Carry on.
In your early days, you had worked as an EMT, and you also did some fight training.
Mm.
Would you recommend for writers that want to become professionals to get some experience in life? And I mean, one thing that you're very good at least in terms of the Atticus Kodiak the fights.
Yeah, I'm very good at... Well, I... That's a hard one. I'm not sure. I believe in research. Mm-hmm. I trained as an EMT, and training as an EMT, I got to understand violence in relation to the body in a different way. If you grow up believing that violence is what you see in movies, that's not violence. You punch somebody in the face, they don't get up again. All right? They don't. You don't punch somebody in the face and have them go, oh, punch back. You punch somebody in the face, they fall down, and then the fight's over. Because the guy who hits the ground first is done. He's not getting up again. You just stomp on him, and that's that. So, and I did not serve, you know, I had friends who were in the course who you know, went on and were paramedics for New York EMS, in the Bronx, one in particular. In fact, I'm naming a character after her in an upcoming work. And, you know, for me, you know, I did minor stuff comparatively. But I got to see violence and pain in a very unfiltered way. I mean, the worst thing that actually happened, this is a digression, writing related, actually. I was living in New York City. Summer of my junior year, I was living with my wife, Jen Van Meter. We were not married at that time. She was working at Oxford University Press, and I was working for an emergency medical instruction company. And I had taken the afternoon off because Robert B. Parker was going to be signing at like Brentano's down in the Battery. And we're in Midtown. We were going to meet at a subway stop around 33rd and Park. I, for some reason, was on the uptown side of the street, if you know Manhattan, right? I'm on the uptown side of the street instead of the downtown side. I still don't know why. I'm standing by the subway entry. I'm about to go in, and I hear a scream. And this woman, and she was a young woman, she couldn't have been much older than her early 20s, comes running up, and she's clutching her neck like this, and there's blood just everywhere. And there is a thing called duty to act. If you are certified as an emergency medical professional, you have a duty to act. You cannot go, oh, I'm sorry, or I'm not seeing it, you know. And even if that wasn't the case, I'm not the kind of person who would have been like, oh, well, that's bad, you know. I grab her, you know, I lay her down, you know. Help her out, you know, and I'm doing all the stuff they teach you, you know, because a bunch of New Yorkers go, wow, that's a lot of blood. You can get AIDS, you know, and I'm doing, you know, you call 911. This woman's been stabbed. Somebody handed me a wet bandana for some reason because the water was going to help. It's like, clean her up. No, that's not the problem. The problem isn't that she's messy. The problem is she's been stabbed in the throat. And, you know, so I'm there, and I'm calming her down. And in that situation, you don't have any equipment. What you do is you treat as best you can. You know, I had her feet elevated, and I've got a hand over the wound. We're keeping pressure on the wound until the medics get there. And and then the EMTs come, and they stabilize her. You know, and the purpose of EMS is not to make you better. The purpose of EMS is to keep you alive until they can get you to someone who can make you better, right? So they go, you know, bagger, cover, load, and they're off to the hospital. And I'm standing there at 33rd and Park, covered in blood. And that's when it hits me. I'm on the wrong side of the street. So I go over to the other side of the street, and there's Jen waiting for me. She takes one look at me, and she's like, "Oh, my Christ!" And I'm like, "No, it's not mine. It's okay." And these are the kind of addled things you think, because there's all this adrenaline going. So what are we going to do? I said, this thing happened. She's going to be all right? I said, "I don't know. I think so." So what do you want to do? I said, "Well, I want to go to the signing." She says, "Don't you think you got to get cleaned up first?" I'm like, "It's New York." I don't know what I was thinking. So we go on. We get into the subway. It's a packed car. And I'm doing this. Never seen a car clear out so fast in your life. Never in your life. By the time we got downtown, I was like, "Yeah, maybe I ought to get this drying blood off me." So, it is 20 years on now, an entertaining anecdote. There are facts in that influence the writing. I'm never going to forget her fear. What happened was, this is a young woman on her way to work. Some guy wanted her purse. She didn't let go of the purse. He stabbed her in the neck. And he missed the carotid. And that's why she is, to my knowledge, alive today. I actually saw her in the hospital a couple days later. That influences. I did fight choreography for theater. Fight choreography for theater is a radically different thing than violence in the real world. It's, you know, in theater, you want to punch somebody and have them stagger back and then punch back. That's dramatic. That's exciting. There are a few things, in all sincerity, to me, as beautiful as a well-choreographed sword fight. I love a good sword fight. Nothing makes me quite as happy as a good sword fight. I can sit there for hours, frame by frame, breaking down a fight. I could write a dissertation on the Princess Bride sword fight between the Man in Black and Inigo Montoya. That is a brilliant, brilliant sword fight. So, you know, for me, what this does is it creates this bizarre marriage between reality and entertainment. Because those fights are for entertainment. That's all they exist for. They exist to entertain you. This is, incidentally, why I love a good sword fight. A good sword fight should be the piece in a microcosm. It should be the whole story in that moment. I think, you know, there's a hoary writer's chestnut that says, write what you know. And novice writers interpret that to mean that they should only write about the things that they have experienced, which is horseshit. Otherwise, we never have science fiction or fantasy. Or I've been mistaken about the reality I'm living in for a real long time. But, you know, I'm reading a science fiction novel right now. I cannot remember the guy's name. It's called Altered Carbon, and it's a fantastic book, and it's killing me that I can't remember the author's name. I think so. You can't write that as something you know. It is entirely speculative. When we say write what you know, we are saying write what is emotionally true. Because that we know. We all know hungry, we all know cold, we all know lonely, we all know picked on, we all know looking longingly at a person we love from afar and having them not know we exist. We all know slamming car door on hand. You know, we know the little things, and these are true eternal moments. And if you can relay those moments of truth, then I can make you believe just about anything. I can make you believe that Superman can fly. If you believe that when he looks at Lois, that love is a sincere Lois, or a sincere love. Sincere Lois. I'm talking too much. So, like I said, long answers. But
actually, next question.
Did I cover a couple of them there?
Yeah, absolutely did. You wear a couple hats with the comic stuff, and then with the novels. Do you find it hard to switch gears?
I don't, because they are two entirely different kinds of writing.
Right.
They are so radically different. And at first I didn't actually see how radically different they are, and the older I've gotten, the clearer it has become. if I'm writing a novel or a short story or whatnot, my job is to grab you and pull you into the story with me and not let you go until the story's over. You don't get an out. If I'm doing my job right, you should look at the clock at 3:30 in the morning and go, God damn, I got to get to work in 2 hours and I'm still up. If I'm writing a comic script, there is an extra layer involved because I can't draw. So a comic script is direct communication with the artist as well as conveying what the story is. So it's a very different mechanism. That is an objective remove. There is literally a process that says, okay, page one, panel one, this is what the image is. And that through the process of the script, ideally what I'm doing is I'm telling the artist, this is the story that we are trying together, collaboratively, to tell. And at the same time, the script also needs to contain the story we are trying to tell. In that sense, a novel is somewhat easier because all the novel is doing is saying, this is the story I'm telling you. There is not a third party involved.
Right.
So.
Now, in terms of your process of creating the script, do you do something like a story map to block out, say, 21 pages of the comic, or start in writing at page one?
It depends. There are times when I'll see the story very clearly in my head. I will. If anybody read the Detective Comics run with J.H., the second part of Go, the issue that begins with Kate at West Point and ends with the Batman moment, that was an issue that in my head was a complete issue for years. I saw every page. I knew everything that happened in that issue. And if I had not been working with J.H., I would have ended up sitting down and just typing. Since I was working with J.H., our collaboration was very tight. I would call him and I would say, this is what happens to this issue. This is what needs to happen. This is the motion. How are we going to do it? What are the visuals you want? He and I work very, very closely together. Other comics, I will sit down and it will literally be, okay, what needs to be accomplished? And then I will go sometimes page by page. Page one is this, page two is this, page three is this. Sometimes it'll be pages 1 through 5 are this, page 6 this, pages 7 through 12 are this.
Do you actually make notes? Like, do you block it in on like little cards?
I actually was using for a while a program on my laptop called Scrivener, which was kind of like a little fake computer index card thing, and then you could set it up and you could actually write your draft there and then export it. I never mastered the program, but I found that what I would end up doing was that I would write my breakdown in this program, and then I would have my word processor up over here for some reason. There have been times I've done it longhand. Mm-hmm. There have been times where I've used literally my desk blotter. I find that for me, I need to sort of talking cure a lot. Okay. I need to verbalize. Not so much because I want the person I'm speaking to say good, bad, ugly, as much as it is I need to hear myself saying it, that for me the act of speaking it helps crystallize the thought.
Okay.
Because I tend to have a lot of thought. I have two agents. I have a literary agent and I have a Hollywood agent. My literary agent is at this point quite used to me calling him up and saying, so I'm thinking I'm going to do this. And I'm sure that when he gets these calls, what he does is he quietly sets the phone down. And then he goes off and plays with his kids for an hour. And every now and then comes back and goes, And then he goes back. And then eventually he'll be like, yeah, that sounds great, Greg. Go do it. And I don't know why that is. But for me, I do. And for me also, that's what a good editor does. A good editor listens. A good editor's job is to help you tell the story you want to tell, not force you to tell the story they wish they were telling.
So you'll use the artist as sounding board, an editor as a sounding board. Do you talk things over with your partner?
Yeah, I mean, Jen and I tend to run things past each other, but oddly, we also sort of separate. I think it's because, and this is for a couple of reasons, Jen, you know, has the unfortunate, she suffers the unfortunate distinction of being married to me. and has gotten shit for it. You know, and ignorant people go, oh, Van Meter got this job because she's married to Greg Rucka.
Right.
No, she got the job because she's a good writer. She has never once gotten work because of her association with me.
Right.
And I think for that reason, she and I tend to... That's also why I don't think we've ever worked together. So we'll talk to each other, but it tends to be more mechanical.
Right.
It will tend to be very story problem specific. I need to accomplish this. What would you do? With artists, it's a different interaction. I tend to be very much, this is the story. So editor is used for, this is the story, this is the story. And then artist is, this is the story. How do we tell the story? What is the best way to tell the story? Because I'm a really fairly good writer, in my opinion, but I can't draw to save my life.
Right, so sometimes you'll discuss, like, depending on the artist and their strengths, you'll discuss different approaches?
Well, absolutely, because okay. I wouldn't presume to tell an artist how to draw. I mean, most of these guys in there who, you know, are getting paid doing this for a living are men and women who have spent years learning their craft.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a difficult craft. Visual storytelling is not easy. The arrogance of that I would have to possess to go in and say, no, draw it this way, I would be as offended. I expect they would be as offended as I would be if they turned around and said, you wrote the scene wrong. Hey, you know what? You go back to your corner, I'll go back to mine. But it's collaborative. There has to be a give and take. And I never had a tighter collaboration than working with Jim on the Batwoman stuff. I mean, we would talk for hours before I'd start scripting.
Speaking of collaboration, I know you've done some co-writing with Ed Brubaker,
yep.
Eric Trautman?
Trautman.
And on The Question with Denny O'Neill. Can you talk a bit about the process
and
of working
with Jeff and with Mark and with Grant and with Keith? I like it. I think collaboration is a very good thing. I've never in my life written anything so good it couldn't benefit from a rewrite. And I've never in my life had an idea that was so good it couldn't be improved by bouncing it off of somebody. So, you know, each collaboration works differently depending on the project, depending on the purpose, and depending on the purpose. The person. You know, Ed and I, when we were co-writing on Gotham Central, we'd get on the phone, we'd break down the story together, and then we would just divvy up the pages. And it would be a very natural divvy because we had characters we were each shepherding. So if it was going to be Chris and Renee, I would take. If it was going to be, you know, Rami and Marcus, he would take it. And, you know, if it was first shift, they were mine. If it was second shift, it was it. With Eric on Action and also on Checkmate, that tended to be less who and more what. I think Eric writes a better fight scene. Mm-hmm. Than I do. So I say, here, take the fight scene. And you go, okay, and he's doing the fight scene. I'll do this scene over here with Lois. With 52, it was, these 22 pages have to be done. You know, quick, grab some. You know, and everybody falling over each other. And then you'd write your pages, and they'd go around, and everybody would offer notes, and you would rewrite. And it was a very...
Did you enjoy that?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, I enjoyed it, but I can say that as a guy. I enjoyed it in the same way that somebody can say, yes, I enjoyed surviving World War II. I wouldn't go back.
Right.
You know.
It seems like kind of a crazy approach.
It was. You know, look, when we started 52, there were people who literally, I wouldn't have been surprised. It didn't happen. But I wouldn't have been surprised if Vegas had taken odds that we weren't going to make it. You know, people were saying they're never going to make it. They're going to miss shipping. And we knew early on we were not going to miss. We would hit every week. We didn't know if it'd be any damn good, but we knew we'd hit every week. The miracle of 52 for me is that it holds together if you read it as one whole book, you know, all four volumes that they've collected. It holds up. It's not, you know, it's not the pinnacle of comics literature. But by the same token, it's a novel. And I actually feel, there's a piece of me that feels, it's actually the first real graphic novel. You can't, that it's a term that gets bandied about a little freely. And I speak as a novelist, you know. I think 52 is the first time you actually see what a novel can be in a comic, because they gave us all that room. It's 52 issues, 20 pages each.
Wow.
That's a lot of pages. That's roughly about the pages you would need to tell a 100,000-word novel. So,
we're basically in manga territory or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, you talked about having an agent for film work.
Yeah.
I know you wrote for the Batman DVD that was out not that long ago.
Yeah.
And you executive produced on.
Yeah, that was on the contract. That was my agent going, this will get you an extra $5,000.
How did you find that? How did you find the process of having your vision adapted to the screen?
Oh, well, are you asking me what I thought? I'm not sure. I wasn't involved. I wasn't really involved. I was, like I said, I was an executive producer. That was a courtesy.
Right.
I ended up on set for about 3 weeks doing rewrites at one point. And you don't want to know how the sausage is made.
Right.
You don't.
So you were story doctoring the script?
Yeah, but I mean, the Whiteout script was a real troubled script.
Right.
They started shooting, they hadn't finalized the script.
Right.
There were problems with that production. It had to go to Writers Guild for arbitration on who would get credit. There were, I think, ultimately nine writers.
Yeah, I think on the Internet Movie Database they only have about 5 credited. I couldn't find
It's crazy. I'm not. I mean, and I was asked. The guild said, "Do you want to enter arbitration?" I was like, "Hell no, I do not." You know, of like 12 scenes I wrote, maybe 4 of them made it to the movie, and I'm not going to claim. You know, the best way to describe it is this: I went to Montreal wondering how it is Hollywood can make so many bad movies. And I left Montreal 3 weeks later going, how is it they ever managed to make a good one? Everything in the process is weighted against it being successful. Everything. It is just, not even counting egos. I'm not even talking about egos. I'm talking about the fact that you have 250 people whose job it is to make this thing happen on this schedule in this way. And you know, there's a moment, you guys all saw The Fellowship of the Ring. You know that moment when Boromir has chased after Frodo and he collapses and there are those leaves that are hanging from Sean Bean? You know the moment I'm talking about? He pushes himself up. It's the moment where he realizes what an ass he's been. And he's sobbing and there are leaves that are clinging to him and there's one in his hair and so on. And all I could think now when I watch that is, oh my God, how much a nightmare that must have been to match that between takes. Think about it. But you see, this is stuff you don't think about. And then you watch it and you go like, oh my God, the technical proficiency required to be like, no, the leaf is wrong. And I was on set for Whiteout. We were walking through. Steve and I were walking through. And one of the offices, we're looking, and it's an office. And it's cluttered. And they've dressed everything. And I'm looking at the phone. And on the speed dial, they filled in what each of the little speed dial buttons, you know, ops control, weather, and so on, flight control. And I looked at the guy, I said, okay, that's beyond anal. And he looked at me and he said, Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah.
You win. I lose. You win. Because one of you will pause, zoom in, and be like, oh, man, I can't believe they got that wrong.
So would you like to do... I mean, there's a plethora of really good TV being put out. Stuff like The Wire and Tremé. And
I would love to... I mean, look, I am... 5 years ago, you know, we sold Queen and Country or whatnot, and do you want to write it? And I was like, no, I can't. I'm too close to the material. And I don't know how. You know, and I don't like, there's an arrogance involved in saying, I write novels, I can do that well. And I write comics, I can do that well. That does not mean I therefore can write movies
right.
or TV. And it's arrogant to presume it. That doesn't mean I can't learn, and I have worked very hard to learn. And at my where I am now in my life and my career, yes, those are things I want to try now. I would love to do TV. I would love to do TV in a way that I could really I would like to be able to pursue, quote unquote, the whole vision.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to do a show that doesn't cop out about itself, that says this is what we are at the start and is that way at the end. I get really, really pissed off when stories go, we know where we're going, and they don't. I hate it when they lie to you. I hate it. I hate it when writers change things because they think you figured it out, and they think the goal of it is to surprise you. And that's not the goal. If I write a mystery, I don't care if you solve it. I really don't. If I write something that 50,000 people can't figure out, I mean, 50,000 of you and the internet, one of you is going to get it right. Even if you're just guessing blindly. In fact, if you're guessing blindly, somebody will get it right. So the idea that, therefore, I have somehow failed, that's fallacious to me. I really hate that. It changes the nature of what you're doing. My goal is to entertain you. If your entertainment comes from having figured it out, go with God. All right? I don't care if you get there before me. What I care about is if you came with me there. If you enjoyed the trip. That's all. I really hate, and it's become more and more prevalent because of the rise of the internet, writers turning around and going, oh, they figured it out. We have to change it. If the story was good and you believed in it at the start, why do you need to change it at the end? I think that's insulting to you. I really think it insults the audience. Really do. Because then it presumes you didn't notice. Right? And the fact of the matter is, you guys are smarter than me. And that's the way I always write. I always write to an audience smarter than I am. Because I sure as hell am not going to talk down to you. I talk down to you, you guys leave. Nobody wants to be insulted.
At the recent WonderCon, you announced you're going to be leaving D.C. to focus on your own projects. Will that include more Queen and Country and more Stumptown?
Well, Stumptown's ongoing.
Okay.
So the fourth issue was supposed to be out at the end of May. We're having horrible schedule trouble with that. I expect it will be out by San Diego Con. I am working on the second story arc right now. The goal with Stumptown was to solicit the arc, do four issue arcs, take about 4 months off, do another four issues, and that's still the goal. Queen and Country, the new novel, as you said at the beginning, the last run is a Queen and Country novel. It sets up a status quo that would set the framework for a Queen and Country series two. I am talking to James Lucas Jones at ONI about how we might go about doing that. And then there are other things I'm working on. So.
Great.
Yep.
Anything else you can tell us about?
Nope.
That's it for now. Okay,
Nope. I will say there's a project that Rick Burchett and I are working on called American Soldier. We're looking for a publisher on that right now. So.
Great. That's fantastic. We've only got a few more minutes.
Yeah, because I talked and talked and talked.
I would love to throw it out to the audience for a couple of minutes. Anybody got anything they'd like to ask?
Ask loudly.
As someone who's obviously experienced in writing Batman and comics, and obviously someone who's also experienced in cinema, what would you like to see executed in Nolan's next Batman film coming out in 2024?
I'd like to see them stop apologizing for it being Batman. I really resent that. I really do. I really hate that. I'll tell you, this is. You want to know my problem with Dark Knight? This is my problem with Dark Knight. They had to spend $30 million and 20 minutes of screen time justifying how Batman was going to get a guy out of Hong Kong, right? This whole sequence about, and here's the harness and the kind of plane and what you're going to do, and we found the plane and everything. How did the Joker manage to wire up a hospital and two ferries with fertilizer bombs, apparently working alone? So why do the Nolans feel that you guys can't accept Batman as Batman? Why do they have to keep apologizing for it? And yet, you can't have it both ways, right? either the Joker has to be bound by the same realism, or it's a comic book movie. Did anybody walk into that theater not knowing who the Dark Knight was? This is why the Iron Man movies have been so good. Because they never apologize. They never once go, yeah, we know he's wearing a costume. They never are sorry for it. They're gleeful, and that's actually why I think the first movie is so good, because Downey captures that glee. When he first gets his, you know, gets the armor and he tries it out, that's one of the most fun moments in the film. You giggle with him and you share that glee, and everything in Batman's so dour. It's so grim. And it's like, you know what, you can tell a serious Batman story and not have to keep apologizing for Batman. And I don't like that. And I like the first one quite a lot, but the more I thought about it, the more and more trouble I had with the second one. I have no idea what they're going to do with the third. I suspect they will. This is just me guessing. I'm thinking probably Bane and Killer Croc. Oh no! They'll do Ivy. They have to do Ivy. They're going to need a woman, so it'll either be Ivy or it'll be Catwoman, and they won't go to Robin, and they will justify some monstrosity in some way. But again, it'll have to be justified, right? He won't be Killer Croc. He'll be, you know.
Riddler?
No, the problem with Riddler is you have to do him right, and I don't think they can do him right. No, I mean, Riddler has to be. There's a great Mark Waid joke that he once told me. Everybody thinks Batman's the smartest guy in Gotham, and he's not. There should be two people who are always smarter than him who undo themselves. The first is Penguin. Penguin's self-loathing should always be the thing that undoes him. And the second is Riddler, and the Riddler joke goes this way. Batman is in Commissioner Gordon's office, and they are looking for the Riddler, and the phone rings. And the Commissioner, yes, Batman is the Riddler. And Batman says, Riddler, where are you? And Riddler says, Batman, I'm trapped. They've tied me to a bomb. I'm going to die. You've got to get me out of here. I've got 3 minutes left. And Batman says, tell me where you are, Enigma. And the Riddler says, I'm if a rooster crows twice at dawn. Right? He can't help it. It's pathological. I am smarter than you. I am smarter than you. That's got to be the Riddler. The Riddler has to be going, I'm smarter than you. And I will do anything to prove it. Up to and including blowing myself up. Just to prove the point that I'm the smartest person here. This is why he's so hard to do. Also, Riddler, not sexy. You can't make him sexy. There's a reason why they cast Jim Carrey. There's a sex symbol for you. Next? Next question?
We have time for one
quickly,
more.
Quickly, quickly. We'll do lightning round.
Anybody else?
Otherwise, I'll leave. Leave! Okay. Really? Nothing else? Come on.
With the Queen's Country series, every story arc, you had different artists come on board. Mm-hmm. You had some repeating, but basically different artists for every story.
Brian Hurt and Steve Ralston repeated, yeah.
How did you make the decision for which artists to have for each story?
Oh, it didn't work like that. What happened was I would write the arc, and the editors at Oni, at first Jamie Rich, and then it was James Lucas, would be like, here are some artists, what do you think? Or mostly they would come and they'd say, this person really wants to work with you. And I would go, okay, woohoo. And that would be it. See, I was younger and I was much more arrogant then. I have learned a lot, in particular in the last couple of years, about working with artists. And I thought I knew more. One of the things I've discovered is some artists want to collaborate, some artists want to be left the hell alone. I had assumed all of them wanted to be left the hell alone. These days now, I actually try to make an effort to determine, what do you need from me? How much give and take do you want? So Southworth, you know, on Stumptown, we don't sit and talk through every issue, but he gets every issue knowing, absolutely knowing, If there's anything here, he calls me. If he's got an idea, he calls me, he lets me know, and he's free to, he's got room to move, he's got room to play. And that is the understanding, that's our agreement. And that's, say, very different than how I work with JH, which was, here, Jim, is the story we want to tell. Here, Greg, is the visuals I see for it. Okay, how do we make these things marry? And it would sort of manifest like that.
That's great. I think with that, we'll end it. We've run out of time.
Oh, no!